Chapter 37. Revolution in Russia. Germany had managed to delay America's intervention from 1915 to 1917. Submarines had been withheld from combat, apologies given and reparations paid, but time had now run out. Within months the United States would be able to send 750,000 soldiers to do battle in Europe. The American Navy would seize German ships stationed in neutral ports, and South American navies would be pressured into following suit. The Navy would in fact replace the 600,000 tons of British shipping which the Germans sank every month. Within a year, 2 million U.S. troops would be fighting alongside the Allies. Germany lost its race against time. The Russian front had been baneful for Germany. It was responsible for losing the Marne battle in France, when General von Moltke, panicked by the Russian advance in Prussia, had deprived his right flank of two army corps. It was a war both the Kaiser and Tsar Nicholas II had tried to avoid to the last minute. The two monarchs were cousins and maintained good personal and national relations. The Tsar was a peaceful man, rather soft and sad. He would never have been involved in war had he not been railroaded into it by the Panslavic cabal and other conspirators. He regretted constantly that he had been forced to declare war on Germany against his wish. The Germans had immediately tried to bring to an end a feudal war which tied down half their army. In December 1914, the Kaiser delegated his advisor, Jewish financier Albert Bollin, who owned most of the German merchant fleet, to negotiate a truce, with the King of Denmark acting as official intermediary. Talks were held with Count Witt, a leading Russian diplomat. The negotiations stalled when the Tsar felt he could not make peace without the Allies' agreement. From March to May 1915, a new attempt for peace was made. German Foreign Minister von Jago informed the Tsar that Germany, in exchange for peace, would prevail on its own Turkish allies to let Russia realize its ambitions in Constantinople and the Dardanelles, where the British had just received a severe thrashing. The secret proposals, dated March 10 and May 25, 1915, were transmitted by Maria Vasilchikova, the Tsaritsa's lady-in-waiting. The war lobby in Russia quickly sabotaged this initiative. No sooner was the Tsar in possession of the proposals than a plot was engineered to disgrace the Tsaritsa's aide. The Tsar failed to stand by her and let her be stripped of her title and exiled by his own enemies. 3 months later, a third attempt was made. This time it was conducted by the president of the Deutsche Bank, Hrmunkevich. The new offering still included Constantinople and also added a 10 billion gold mark loan. On August 11, 1915, the negotiations were scuttled by the pro-war minister Sazonov. A fourth attempt, organized by the Grand Marshals of Germany and Russia, also failed. The Marxist Revolution of March 1917 was launched to the cries of "Down with the war!" That was good news for the German military planners. The Tsar had recently declared again his unswerving support for the Allies, and his overthrow changed Russia's position. But if the German government was to get any benefit from a Russian withdrawal, speed was of the essence. The Zimmermann telegram affair was hastening America's entry into the war. The Tsar's demise was well organized and swift. Despite his weakness and incompetence, he had decided to lead the Russian armies personally, with disastrous results. Many of his generals were equally inept, and his ministers were chosen on the advice of the lice-ridden degenerate Rasputin, who was himself advised by his constant shadow, the Jewish usurer Simanovich. The Tsar referred to Rasputin as a saint called Gregory from the province of Tobolsk. The Rasputin-Simanovich manipulation of the imperial family had gone on for 11 years. Rasputin had mesmerized the Tsaritsa and her daughters. Rasputin spoke and the Tsaritsa rushed to implement his orders, while at the same time she treated her husband with condescension. "I suffer for you just as if you were a helpless small child in need of guidance, but yet listen to bad advisers, while the man sent by God tells you what to do." Rasputin's hold was such that when he sent an apple to the Tsar to strengthen his resolve, the potentate of all the Russias did not dare eat it because he regarded it as a holy relic. Rasputin's reign finally came to an end on December 17, 1916, when he was poisoned, repeatedly shot and then thrown into the icy Neva River by his enemies at court. The imperial family was devastated by Rasputin's death. They followed, pathetic and isolated, his funeral cortege. His hearse carried an icon inscribed with the names Alexandra, Olga, Tatiana, Maria and Anastasia, the Tsaritsa and her daughters. The British ambassador in Russia himself was at the center of a scheme to overthrow the Tsar if he should ever lose his stomach for war. London was apprehensive, the shock of Rasputin's demise might drive the Tsar to peace. The ambassador had gathered a coterie of wealthy bankers, liberal capitalists, conservative politicians, and disgruntled aristocrats to overthrow the Tsar. Because of his hatred for Germany, the British favored Grand Duke Nicholas to succeed the Tsar. Since 1914, the British ambassador had aided and abetted the conspirators, but their very disparity neutralized any positive effect they might have had on the Russian monarchy. Nevertheless, British intervention into the internal affairs of Russia robbed Russian nationalists of any chance of surviving the coming onslaught of international communism. While Russia was drowning in subversion and treason, only the Tsaritsa displayed any firmness of character. She exhorted her husband to assert himself and take charge. "You must not give proof of weakness. The Duma has no right to make war and peace pronouncements, that's your decision. Bang the table with your fist, do not make concessions, show them who is the boss, and believe your tough little wife. Russia likes the bite of the whip, Russia craves it. Be like Peter the Great, Ivan the Terrible or Tsar Paul, crush all before you." The pious and humble Tsar could neither conceive nor comprehend such exhortations. He prayed God for a solution, but he was paralyzed with indecision. The British had spread rumors that the Tsaritsa was pro-German, because of her German background, and was working for a separate peace with Germany. General Denikin wrote in his memoirs, "Everyone knows that Tsaritsa is demanding a separate peace at any cost. There has never been any documentation to back this allegation. Nor has there ever been proof that Rasputin was connected with the Germans." Trotsky himself admitted in his History of the Russian Revolution, "Even after the revolution, not the slightest proof was discovered that established a link between Rasputin and the German army." As peace-loving as the Tsar was, he remained totally loyal to the Allies, who for their part were only using him. On March 7, 1917, only a week before being overthrown, and 5 months before being murdered at Ekaterinburg, the Tsar gave assurances to French Minister Dumergue that Russia would remain firmly committed to the Allied war. The Tsar's unrequited loyalty to the Allies had divorced him from the realities of Russia. The war had drained Russia's enormous resources and food supplies had been reduced by half. Bankers' speculations had raised the cost of living by 300% and the people went hungry. "There will be massive food riots at any time," a police report stated in January 1917. Gloom was the order of the day among the Tsar's corrupt and incompetent ministers. Navy Minister Grigorovich kept repeating, "No one in the armed forces trusts us anymore." War Minister Polivanov lamented, "The dam is cracking and catastrophe can no longer be contained." Imperial Russia was propped up by the rotten pillars of a false elite. On February 23, 1917, St. Petersburg had a garrison of 180,000 men, almost 10 divisions. 4 days later, they would flee in panic. The revolution started with a march of 90,000 women textile workers. They were on strike because they were hungry, and for no other reason. To cries of "bread not war," they marched in orderly fashion, without the backing of any political parties. The next day the men, who had noticed little police interference, went on strike. They joined the women marchers to the cries of "down with the war" and "down with autocracy." Some students and petty bourgeois elements also joined in the improvised march. Not a single political party supported these demonstrations. The crowd was tired of so much death in a war they did not understand, and tired of being hungry. When the police were ordered to contain them, the crowd good-naturedly invited them to join the march. There were no incidents. The authorities and the bureaucracy had no understanding of what motivated these people. That Tsaritsa blamed the situation on a Jewish politician she called Kedrinsky, I would like to believe that this Kedrinsky will be hanged for his seditious speeches. He must hang now. That will be an example, to the others, she cabled her husband. Kedrinsky, or rather Alexander Kerensky, a left-wing socialist, was instead invited to join the cabinet a week later. On February 25, 1917, the streets of St. Petersburg were filled. Orators harangued the crowds. War Minister Polivanov was unconcerned. There are, he cabled the Tsar, at Mogilev, a few strikes. They are of no importance. The Tsaritsa informed her husband the next day, everything is quiet in St. Petersburg. Nevertheless, there had been some shooting, and some people had been killed. The Tsaritsa sent another telegram in the evening, things are taking a turn for the worse in the capital. She urged that order be restored. On February 27, 1917, a battalion of Georgians was brought into St. Petersburg. The 4th Company of the Pavlovsky Regiment suddenly started shooting at the police, but casualties were light. Some of the mutineers were jailed, but others took their place. The incident created enough confusion to shift the soldiers' loyalties to the side of the protesters. Armed men began marching with the crowds they had been sent to stop. The Russian government declared a state of emergency in St. Petersburg, but the bureaucracy was in such disarray that the notices could not be posted for lack of brushes and glue. Trotsky commented sarcastically, the authorities couldn't even stick a poster on a wall. Police Chief Rodzianko sent the Tsar a telegram, the moment of truth has arrived. The future of the country and the dynasty is being decided now. The Tsar read the telegram but did not understand it. This fat Rodzianko is again sending me nonsense I do not even think of bothering to answer. In the face of government indecision, the crowds took the initiative. Prisons were opened and prisoners joined a march towards the Mariinsky Palace, where the government was in session. The politicians and bureaucrats were terrified at the news. They switched off all the lights and hid themselves in closets and underneath desks and tables. The panic subsided when it was learned the crowd had gone somewhere else. The president of the council, Prince Golitsyn, was so shaken up he asked Rodzianko, "Be kind enough not to ask me for anything, because I have resigned." Meanwhile, the crowd had entered another palace, the Taurid, where the Duma, the Russian Legislative Assembly, conducted its deliberations. The Tsar had just dissolved the Duma, but a provisional one had been set up in its stead. The chamber was crowded with thousands of people, with hundreds making speeches in a carnival atmosphere. Kerensky rushed to the crowd with open arms. No one quite knew how to deal with his effusions. New cabinet ministers were appointed at random, and Prince Lvov was hosted on a group's shoulders and declared head of the government by acclamation. The only cohesive groups amid the chaos were the Soviets. Soviet cells spread across Russia waiting for the opportune moment to move against the wobbly Russian government. It is remarkable that until this point, not a single leftist leader had directed the crowds. People demonstrated against hunger and the war, but made no specific demands. Confusion was the order of the day. Far away, at the front, the Tsar sent his wife a telegram on February 8, "The weather here is splendid. I am sure you are well and peaceful. Strong troop detachments have been sent to the front. Lovingly yours, Nika." The Tsaritsa was quick to reply that all was not well, it is necessary to make concessions. Strikes are continuing and many troops have gone over to the revolution. At Helsinki, several officers had been thrown alive beneath the frozen ice. It was only then that the Tsar realized something was wrong. He left his headquarters to join his family. His train was constantly stopped by the mobs who had taken control of the railways. At St. Petersburg, his personal guard had mutinied against its officers and was demanding their arrest. The infantry had gone over to the revolution, and most of the generals had fled, including the governor of St. Petersburg. On March 14, 1917, the Tsar, crushed by widespread betrayal, agreed to the formation of a new government. But it was too late. His weakness had allowed treason to prosper and his power was gone. Grand Duke Nicholas urged him to abdicate. The Tsar wanted nothing more. He persevered at his position only from a sense of God-ordered obligation to fulfill a sacred duty. He informed his generals that he was willing to sign their demand, "I agree to abdicate in favor of my son who will stay by my side until his majority, and to name my brother Grand Duke Michael Alexandrovich as regent of Russia." The abdication was not enough for some politicians. On March 15, 1917, Petrograd representatives Gushkov and Chulgin demanded that the Tsar sign his abdication in favor of his brother Michael alone, and accept Prince Lvov as council president. The next day the reign of Tsar Michael ended abruptly and the crowd shouted that they didn't want any Romanov on the throne. Thus ended one of Europe's oldest dynasties, it was shouted out of power. The Tsar never realized that his weakness was responsible for his demise. In his farewell address to the Russian army, he still displayed an amazing lack of perception as well as a misguided loyalty to the allies who had betrayed him. "Whoever thinks of peace in these days, whoever wants peace, is a traitor to the fatherland. Keeping an alliance with unworthy allies was more important than saving his own country." The new government seemed to be even more determined than the Tsar to keep Russia in the war. On March 21, 1917, the new foreign minister Paul Milyukov declared, "The international obligations which will be honored by the Russian Republic also include agreements concluded secretly." Thus, despite 4 million dead, the new Russian Republic would continue sacrificing Russian blood for the Allies. The Allies were delighted. The French and British politicians were of the opinion that the new Russian Republic would send more troops to the front. The Republic's commitment to war was bad news for Germany. It meant maintaining a huge army on the Eastern Front and risking being overrun by the Americans. For German war strategists, the demise of the new Russian Republic was a matter of survival. It had to be brought down at any cost. The downfall of the Tsar did not bring the communists to power. In the spring of 1917, there was scarcely a single hardcore revolutionary in St. Petersburg or Moscow. Stalin had returned from Siberia, but he lived in the shadows, barely surviving. The Germans knew the only man who could make Russia explode was Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, also known as Lenin. They also knew that to enlist Lenin for that purpose was very dangerous, he could inflame Europe as well as Russia.